and a girl's. Sabrina. Here, upstairs in the house. Had they been in Pick's bedroom? Jesse slammed open the door to her room and stormed out. "Hey, Jesse," Pick said. "I heard the babies were born. A boy and a girl. That's so cool." Jesse glared at Sabrina. "You know you two aren't allowed up here without an adult present." Sabrina, who up until that point had been nothing but nice to Jesse, transformed into the witchy person Jesse had been hoping she was. "What are you going to do, tell on us?" "I could," Jesse said. "My family is already considering tossing Pick and his grandfather out. If my mother finds out Pick has you up here, I bet she'll be pretty angry." "Jesse," Pick said. He was afraid. Jesse could see it on his face. Jesse realized she had power. Sabrina shrugged. "Whatever. I have to get home to shower." She turned to Pick. "See you at work." She kissed him, and the kiss turned into something long and sloppy. Jesse's stomach lurched, and she nearly vomited right there, but Pick pushed Sabrina away. He, at least, had some sense of propriety. Sabrina vanished down the stairs, leaving Jesse and Pick to stare at each other. "Jesse," he said. "A few days ago," Jesse said, "the person you were kissing like that was me." "I know, Jesse, but..." "But what?" "That was before I knew Sabrina liked me back," he said. This answer was a slap in the face, but Jesse was proud of herself. She didn't even flinch. She simply stared at him with all the hate she could muster. "I like you, Jesse, but you're only 13. Sabrina is 15. We work together. I've liked her since the second I saw her. She's so pretty. I mean, you're pretty too, and you're really nice, but you like Sabrina. You asked her to go steady, and you asked her to go to Woodstock with you. You do remember that you asked me to go to Woodstock, right?" "Right," Pick said. "But I was only kidding." He swallowed. "Not kidding, ha-ha, but I mean, we both know you were never going to be allowed to go to Woodstock." "You aren't allowed to go to Woodstock," Jesse said, her voice growing belligerent. "There's no way Mr. Crimmins is going to let you go, so you'll have to sneak away with Sabrina, and I'm sure you'll get caught." Jesse wanted to believe this was true, but she also had confidence in Pick's street smarts. He and Sabrina would go to Woodstock, hear the bands, dance together, and fall asleep curled up in the back of someone's truck. Pick would find his mother and introduce her to Sabrina, his girlfriend. Jesse could see it all clearly. Pick and Sabrina, and not Jesse. Jesse would be here on Nantucket, dutifully going to tennis lessons and changing diapers and waiting to hear if her brother was dead or alive. "Jesse," Pick said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I think you're terrific. I mean, we're friends still, right?" Tears dripped down Jesse's face. It was him being nice that undid her, because all she wanted to do was hate him. "Friends?" Jesse said. She tilted her head. "I'm not sure about that, Pick. I'm not sure at all." She felt energized by this answer, and she had watched enough soap operas with Blair to know what to do next. She spun on her heel, retreated to her room, and closed the door quietly but firmly behind her. Jesse decides that Tiger does not need to hear about her grand humiliation, her broken heart, or her subsequent hangover, a headache so bad it felt like her skull might crack. She now understands the appeal of drinking, but also the consequences. Not worth it. So that's the story of the birth of our niece and nephew. Blair isn't coming home until Sunday. Because she had twins, she gets to stay in the hospital a really long time. And when the babies get here, I'm going to show them your photo and tell them about their brave Uncle Tiger. I miss you. Write soon. Love, Messy. The next day, life returns to normal, though the very last thing Jesse wants to do is go to her tennis lesson. She tries to get out of it by asking to accompany Kate to the hospital to see the babies, but Kate informs her that George is being circumcised that morning, and therefore the afternoon would be better for a visit. Jessie isn't sure exactly what circumcision is, but when she asks, Kate shakes her head as if to say it isn't a subject for polite conversation. And so Jessie and Exalta set out for the club, first swinging by the post office so Jessie can drop her letter to Tiger in the mailbox. Exalta looks on with an expression of indulgence and pity, as though Jessie were mailing a letter off to Santa Claus. Jessie's anger at Pic is still lingering. She glares at Exalta. "Do you ever write to Tiger?" Exalta says, "Come along or we'll be late." But Jessie persists. She's tired of being ignored, disregarded, redirected. "Nani, do you write to Tiger? Have you written to him even once since he's been overseas?" "No," Exalta says. The syllable hangs in the air, naked and cruel, and Exalta must realize this because she says, "Perhaps I should." Jessie wants to scream, "Perhaps you should? Perhaps?" But she has learned recently that silence is more powerful than a furious outburst. When they arrive at the club, Jessie feels the need to steal again, steal something right from under Exalta's nose. But that would backfire. Instead, she peels off for the locker room so she can calm herself before her lesson. "Don't dilly-dally," Exalta says. "I'm off to find Mrs. Winter." Jessie slams into the locker room. She's so angry she wants to smash the mirrors with her racket, but she stops short. Sitting on the love seat in the lounge is one of the Dunscombe twins, sobbing into her hands. "Hello?" Jessie says gently. She isn't sure if it's Helen or Heather. If she knew it was Helen, Jessie would just ignore her, but she likes Heather and feels bad about stealing her money. The twin looks up. Helen. Now Jessie is stuck. "Everything okay?" she asks in a way that she hopes sounds rhetorical. Helen struggles for a breath. "I hate my tennis instructor," she says. Jessie nearly rolls her eyes. It figures that Helen Dunscombe is crying over something stupid like tennis. I want to kill him." What snags Jessie's attention aren't the words. Everyone wants to kill someone. It's the guttural tone of Helen's voice and the way she's clenching her fists. Jessie starts to ask who Helen's instructor is, but then she remembers it's Garrison Howe. And then Jessie gets it. Although she does not like Helen at all, she sits down on the edge of the coffee table in front of her. "Garrison," she says, "did he..." She doesn't even have words at her disposal. She clears her throat. "He touched you, right?" Helen stops crying for a second and looks at Jessie in astonishment before she whispers, "How did you know?" "He rubbed against me during our first lesson," Jessie says. "I ran. I told my mother the first time it happened," Helen says. "She told me I was being dramatic and to stop exaggerating. Then he did it again. He ran the back of his hand over my breast while he was correcting my serve. And when I told my mother that time, she said all men are like that and I should just get used to it." Jessie blinks. She wasn't brave enough to tell Kate or anyone else for exactly that reason. "We could both go and tell Ollie Hayward," she says. "With both of us, he would have to believe it." Helen shakes her head. "He might believe it, but he won't do anything. Even Heather thinks I'm just looking for a way to switch to Topher." If Jessie didn't know about Garrison, she might have thought this as well. "So you don't want to tell anybody?" Jessie asks. She does the previously unthinkable. She reaches a hand out to Helen. Helen takes it and gives Jessie a weak smile. "Well," she says, "I just told you." Jessie spends her entire tennis lesson smacking the ball like never before. Her forehand is a fireball, her backhand solid and true, and her serve is blistering. Or at least that's how it seems to Jessie, because she is just so angry. Garrison has been taking gross liberties with Helen Dunscombe, and probably with all his other female tennis students, possibly some who are even younger than Helen and Jessie. It's this thought that makes Jessie pocket the ball and approach the net. Susie is on the other side, bent over, both hands on the handle of her racket, in the ready position. "Oh, come on," she says. "Don't stop now. You're on a roll. This is the strongest play I've seen all summer." "Susie," Jessie says, "I have to tell you something." Jessie remembers her father's advice to always think before she speaks. "Before I had you as an instructor, I had Garrison." She stops to breathe. "During our first lesson, he was showing me a two-handed backhand, and he rubbed his body against mine."
"Rubbed it."
"Suggestively?" Susie says. She puts her hands on her hips. "Are you kidding me?" "I ran away," Jessie says, "and I asked my grandmother for another instructor, a girl, and they gave me you."
"Did you tell your grandmother what Garrison did?" Susie says. "Did you tell anyone?"
"No," Jessie says. "Oh, Jessie," Susie says. Her voice is suddenly tender. "You could have told me. You know you could have come to me at any time."
"I'm coming to you now," Jessie says.
The sun is blasting the orange clay court. Jessie is so hot, it feels like she's standing on the surface of the sun. She needs water and shade. But then she imagines the other girl or girls, some maybe only 11 years old or even as young as 10, maybe a girl who will be 12 or 13 next summer if Garrison comes back, and so she keeps talking.
"He touched Helen Dunscombe, too. She was crying in the locker room about it. He touched her breast while he was showing her how to serve. Helen told her mother, and her mother said that's just the way men are."
"What?" Susie shouts. She stands up to her full height and starts bouncing her palm off the face of her racket. "Well, I mean, she's not wrong. Men are like that. But we don't have to put up with it. Jessie, do you hear me? We do not have to put up with it."
"What are we going to do?" Jessie says.
She suddenly regrets her decision to confide in Susie, and she realizes she should never have mentioned Helen Dunscombe by name.
"Are you going to tell Ollie Hayward?"
Jessie envisions being marched into Ollie's office, or maybe even the office of Mr. Bosley, the general manager of the Field and Oar, or, horrors of all horrors, to the Board of Governors, old men like Mrs. Winter's husband. Jessie will have to speak the embarrassing truth, and her name will be sullied, and Helen Dunscombe's name will be sullied. And possibly Helen will turn around and deny it ever happened, and then Jessie will be left exposed and alone. Any which way, it will be worse for Jessie than it will be for Garrison Howe.
"Please, my grandmother, my family, they can't know about this."
Susie's face is shaded by her visor. All Jessie can see clearly in the blinding sun is the white stripe of zinc on Susie's nose. But Jessie can tell Susie is deep in thought.
"I'm not going to tell Ollie," Susie says. "He won't care, and even if he does care, he won't punish Garrison properly. But I will punish Garrison properly. I will see to it that Garrison resigns."
Jessie lets her breath go. Susie understands. Susie is her role model.
"How are you going to do that?" Jessie asks.
"I'm going to enlist the help of Jeffrey Pryor, who has pledged his undying devotion to yours truly." Susie smirks. "He'll do whatever I ask him to."
Jessie is fascinated, but not at all surprised. Susie is a person who inspires devotion.
"Are you going to ask him to beat Garrison up?"
"Better," Susie says. "Jeffrey works two jobs here. He's the grill boy at the snack bar."
Meaning, Jessie thinks guiltily, that he's the one she stole the Twizzlers from. "And he's in charge of the men's locker room." Susie raises her hands above her head in victory. Jessie is confused.
"I don't get it."
"Well, let me enlighten you," Susie says. "I'll ask Jeffrey to put Ben Gay in Garrison's jockstrap, itching powder in his socks, and laxatives in his cokes."
Susie grins. "Trust me, Garrison will be gone within a week." Jessie imagines Garrison hurrying off the court toward the bathroom mid-lesson, fearing he might have a very embarrassing accident in front of everyone. She wants to hug Susie. She can't wait to tell Helen Dunscombe.
"All right, get back to the baseline," Susie says. "You owe me one more volley." All along the watchtower. As soon as Kirby gets to work on Friday, Mrs. Benny informs her that Senator Kennedy and his cousin Joe Gargan have checked into their rooms but are out for the evening. Kirby already knows that the senator is hosting a party out on Chappaquiddick for the Boiler Room Girls, the elite group of women who worked on Bobby Kennedy's 1968 presidential campaign. Patty's sister Sarah was one of the Boiler Room Girls, and she has come to the vineyard to attend the party. That afternoon, when she swung by the Narragansett Avenue house to say hello, she extended an invitation to both Patty and Kirby. Sarah O'Callaghan was nothing like bland Tommy. Clearly the females in the family received the superior genes. Sarah had dark hair and milky skin like Patty, though Sarah's hair was cut in a pixie just like Mia Farrow's, which made her blue eyes seem impossibly big and round. She was slender and fashionable in a red A-line dress and hammered gold earrings. Sarah brought along her friend Mary Jo, another one of the Boiler Room Girls who had worked as Bobby Kennedy's secretary. Mary Jo wore a navy blue linen sheath and pearls. Kirby looked on both Sarah and Mary Jo with awe. They were only 5 or 6 years older than her, but they seemed worldly and sophisticated. Kirby wanted to be just like them. She would become just like them, she decided. Since ending her relationship with Darren the week before, Kirby had been flailing. Who was she? What did she want from life? She needed to shrug off her heartbreak and disillusionment and start to forge a real identity. She would return to the person she was on the morning of the first protest march, when she pulled on her tie-dyed peace sign t-shirt and zipped up her fringed suede boots. That woman was passionate and self-possessed, carefree and confident. Kirby had been feeling like her love affair with Scotty and then her relationship with Darren diminished her. But now she understood she had that backward. Those two relationships, even in their failure, had given Kirby something. Strength, she supposed, and resolve. When she returned to Simmons in September, she would finally declare a major, political science. She would focus on her studies and apply for an internship, maybe at Tip O'Neill's office. Or maybe, just maybe, Kirby would encounter Senator Kennedy at the inn, and he would take a shine to her and offer her his card. There were rumors that he would make a run for president against Nixon. Kirby could not, however, attend the party on Chappaquiddick. She had to work at 11. "Just come for a little while," Patty urged. "It's a barbecue starting at 7. You could leave right after dinner. I'm sure someone will give you a ride to the ferry. Then you can just walk to the inn." She grabbed Kirby's hand, and Kirby saw dark bruises the size of dimes on Patty's wrist. "I wish I could," Kirby said. For 1 second, she considered calling in sick and going to the party. She hadn't missed a night all summer. But this was irresponsible, and she knew there was no way she could endure the party without a drink or a toke. She didn't belong there anyway. If she went, she would be the ultimate hanger-on, Sarah's sister's friend. Her instincts told her the better course of action was to introduce herself to Senator Kennedy later, at the hotel. Still, she'd felt insanely jealous as she helped Patty pick out an outfit. "Does Luke know you're going to this party?" Kirby asked. If she felt jealous, she couldn't imagine how Luke must feel. "It's none of his business," Patty said. And when she caught Kirby's expression in the mirror, she said, "What? He doesn't own me." Mrs. Benny is rarely at the inn this late. Kirby supposes she's here to make sure that everything goes smoothly during the senator's stay. But her lipstick is faded, and strands of hair are escaping from her bun. She looks frazzled, and Kirby nearly tells her to go home, that she can handle things from here. But Mrs. Benny feels compelled to issue one final reminder. "Remember, Catherine, to exercise discretion. The senator's privacy and personal comfort are our first priority." "Yes, ma'am," Kirby says. Kirby proceeds as though everything is normal. Everything is normal except for Kirby's heightened state of awareness. At any moment, the senator might come strolling through the front door. It will be enough just to see him, Kirby decides. Just to say, "Have a good night." Teddy Kennedy is young and handsome, although not quite as handsome as Bobby and nowhere near as handsome as President Kennedy. What would it be like to be a member of such a family? Kirby wonders. She supposes Teddy Kennedy thinks of his brothers the same way that she thinks of Blair and Jesse. Two by two, guests enter the lobby, then head up to bed. A few of the women stop to compliment Kirby's dress, a yellow shift embroidered with daisies that's the brightest, most cheerful dress she owns. She reviews the bills at the front desk rather than in the back office so she doesn't miss anything or anybody. When she's finished, she allows herself 15 minutes to indulge in thoughts of Darren. He had driven her home from Lobsterville Beach in silence, and she thought he'd resigned himself to her way of thinking. He was too close to his parents for their relationship to proceed any further. But before she climbed out of the car, he took her hand and pressed it to his lips. "I don't want you to go," he said. "I like you, Kirby." "Yes," she said. "I like you, too."
"Maybe when we're both back in the city, at school, we can..."
She opened the door and got out without letting him finish. She knew what he was proposing, that they revisit things in the fall, after they were back in school, after he was out of his parents' house. Kirby could see how that idea would be appealing. They would have 9 months to let their love blossom and grow without static from that pesky little thing called family. But it wouldn't be real. Kirby was content to cast Darren as the weak one. But would she have the courage to bring Darren home to Kate and David? Yes, of course. Her parents were fair-minded. What about Exalta? Here, Kirby came as close to understanding Darren's predicament as she could. She would not relish the idea of introducing Darren to her grandmother. It wasn't meant to be, Kirby thought. She'd hitched her bag over her shoulder, marched into the house, ascended to the igloo, and thrown herself onto the bed. The next day there was a knock on her door. Michaela. Kirby supposed she was there to tell Kirby to stop playing her Simon and Garfunkel album over and over again. "Go away," Kirby said. "Darren's on the phone," Michaela said. "Tell him I'm out," Kirby said. Michaela put a hand on her hip. "You're asking me to lie?" "Yes," Kirby said. "If you object on moral grounds, then just hang up and take the phone off the hook. Please?" Michaela shrugged. "Maybe I'll see if he wants to go out with me," she said. "He's cute." Kirby tries to put that conversation out of her mind. She shuffles the bills until they're in an even pile, then returns them to the file folder with a sigh. At 1:30, a man comes striding into the lobby and makes a beeline for the desk. It takes Kirby a second to recognize Luke. He doesn't look like himself. His hair is wild and his face is bright red. He's sweating, and his eyes are bulging like a bullfrog's. He's wearing a green t-shirt with a rip in the neck and a pair of loose-fitting drawstring pants. He's in his pajamas, Kirby realizes, and immediately she knows something's wrong. "Luke," she says, "did something happen to Patty?" Luke smacks both hands down on the desk and bellows, "You tell me. Where is she? She's not at home, she's not at the movie theater, and her brother, that idiot, said he hasn't seen her, so that leaves you. I thought you two were out whoring around since she said you broke up with your darky boyfriend, but look, here you are." He leans across the desk and grabs Kirby by the wrist. "Let go of me," she says softly. She doesn't want to wake any guests. "Where is she?" Luke asks. He twists Kirby's wrist and it hurts so bad she's sure it will snap. "I have no idea," Kirby says, but her words aren't convincing even to her own ears. "Tell me," he roars. The pain in Kirby's wrist is building. The more she struggles to free herself, the sharper the pain becomes. "She went to a party," Kirby nearly says, "on Chappie." But before she can get the words out, she hears a deep voice.
"Hey!"
They both turn, and Luke releases Kirby's wrist. It's Mr. Ames. Sweet, kind, understanding Mr. Ames, who looks anything but that at this moment. He grabs Luke by the front of the t-shirt and nearly lifts him off the ground. You bothering the lady? No, Luke says.
This is Luke Winslow, my housemate's boyfriend, Kirby says. He came here looking for Patty, but I don't know where she is.
Mr. Ames lets Luke go. You have no business showing up at this hotel to harass people. I saw you hurting Miss Foley here. How about I call the Edgartown police?
He pulls his walkie-talkie off his hip. Luke hangs his head and starts to blubber. Kirby rolls her eyes.
He must be drunk, she says. How did you get here, Luke? Did you drive?
He raises his head.
Where is she? He asks plaintively. I just want to know the truth. Is she out with someone else?
For crying out loud, Mr. Ames says. I'm calling the police.
Wait, Kirby says. She comes out from behind the desk and speaks into Mr. Ames's ear. The senator will probably be back any minute. I don't think we should call the police.
Mr. Ames checks his watch.
You're right.
Could I maybe borrow your car and drive him home? Kirby asks.
Where does he live?
Mr. Ames asks.
Chilmark, Kirby says, off the state road.
That's too far, Mr. Ames says. You'll be gone 40 minutes at least. Call the kid a cab.
Okay, Kirby says.
She phones for a taxi while Luke collapses onto the sofa in the lobby and Mr. Ames stands guard over him. Kirby thinks back on all the quiet shifts she worked when she longed for action, and now she has action on the worst of all possible nights. Senator Kennedy could appear at any moment, and instead of walking into a warm, welcoming lobby, he'll see Luke, who was alternately crying into his hands and angrily muttering that he's going to make Patty pay for what she's doing. Maybe they should call the police, Kirby thinks. Yes, they should. Luke is dangerous. But then Kirby thinks about Mrs. Benny's warnings and reminders. If Mrs. Benny finds out that the police showed up at the inn on the senator's first night because of a friend of Kirby's, they need to get him out of there.
We need to get him out of here, Kirby says, mostly to herself.
Outside, the cab pulls up.
Let's go, Luke, Kirby says with false cheer.
Go sleep it off, buddy, Mr. Ames says.
Reluctantly, Luke gets to his feet.
You got it from here? Mr. Ames asks. I'm going back to my post.
All set, Kirby says.
She pulls Luke toward the front door. Come on. Luke stumbles down the stairs to the taxi. He's so drunk, and he's also very clearly a psychopath. This role-playing that he and Patty have been doing is just a euphemism or else a flat-out cover-up for him abusing her.
He doesn't own me, Patty said. But he does in a way, Kirby sees now. He hurts her to keep control, and she lets him.
The cab driver gets out to open the door for Luke. He's young and slight of frame, a pipsqueak. Honestly, he looks to be about Jesse's age. Kirby wishes they had sent someone else.
Where are you headed? The driver asks.
He's going to Chilmark, Kirby says. State Road.
I'm going to Oak Bluffs, Luke says. Narragansett Avenue.
No, Kirby says.
She has, wisely, brought $5 from the petty cash drawer to pay for the taxi.
He's going to Chilmark. The address is... Luke, what's your address?
Luke crawls into the back seat. Narragansett Avenue, Oak Bluffs.
Kirby presses the $5 bill into the pipsqueak cabbie's hand. Take him to Chilmark. Only to Chilmark. He lives off the state road.
But where off the state road? The cabbie asks. There aren't many streetlights up island, and there are a lot of houses tucked back in the woods. I don't want to be driving around all night looking for the right place. Oak Bluffs, Luke growls.
Kirby glances back at the inn. She can't leave, but she can't risk Luke going to Oak Bluffs either. He'll find Patty and make her pay. Kirby imagines a black eye or worse. Mr. Ames told Kirby it was not okay for her to go to Chilmark because it would take too long, and it's obviously against the rules for Kirby to leave the property while she's on the clock. It wouldn't matter if this took only 5 minutes. But in the moment, it feels like Mr. Ames doesn't care about Patty's safety, which means he's technically siding with Luke.
Which makes sense because they're both men and the entire country is one big oppressive patriarchy. Kirby slides into the front seat. There's no way she's sitting in the back with Luke. I'll tell you where to go, she says to the cabbie, and then you can bring me back here. Just drive. Drive as fast as you can. When Kirby gets back to the inn, she's gone the better part of an hour because they missed the turn and had to double back. The lobby is quiet, and the senator's room key has been claimed. Kirby's spirits are in a free fall. Are things okay or not? She walks down the hall to find Mr. Ames dozing in his chair by the side entrance. Gently, Kirby touches his arm, and he startles awake. Kirby, he says. He gets to his feet, shaking his head. I told you not to leave. Who did you think was going to handle the desk when the senator got back? Kirby clings to what's left of her self-righteous rage. I had to go, she says. Luke wanted the cabbie to take him to my house in Oak Bluffs. He would have found Patty. He hurts her, Mr. Ames.
I understand you wanted to help your friend, but you have a job, Kirby, and with that job comes responsibility. Any idea how concerned I was when you just ran off without telling me?
I'm so sorry, she says.
Mr. Ames says, Well, you're lucky. The senator came in the side door, and I was right here, so I went and fetched his key. He didn't look much better than that other punk, to be honest.
Really? Kirby says. Was he drunk?
He was something, Mr. Ames says. Looked like he went swimming in all his clothes. He was disoriented, I guess, which was why he came knocking on the side door. He kept asking the time. I told him it was 2:30, and he asked if I was sure it wasn't earlier, so I had to lead him over to the clock and show him. Funny thing is, he was wearing a watch.
Mr. Ames shrugs. Maybe it stopped. Mrs. Benny makes a surprise appearance at 7 a.m. She looks crisp and fresh in a shamrock green shirtwaist dress and pearls. It's the first time Kirby has ever seen her boss with her hair down. She looks 10 years younger, softer, prettier. Kirby supposes she wants to make a good impression on the senator. Compared to this new, glamorous version of Mrs. Benny, Kirby feels wan and exhausted. Despite her keen desire to meet the senator, Kirby is relieved when Mrs. Benny tells her she can go home. I'm asking Mr. Ames to stay until 9, Mrs. Benny says. So you'll have to find another ride back to Oak Bluffs, I'm afraid. It's not a problem. Kirby is too disconcerted by the events of the night to impose on Mr. Ames for a ride anyway. She calls a taxi, and they send a burly driver covered in tattoos who looks like a long-haul fisherman. Why couldn't they have sent this guy last night? Kirby wonders. That would have solved everything. Kirby promptly falls asleep in the back seat, awakening only as they turn onto Circuit Avenue, at which point she sits up and gathers her things. She can't believe she missed the senator. She hates Luke Winslow. And then, as though she has somehow conjured him with this one thought, Kirby sees Luke pacing on the sidewalk in front of the house. No, she thinks. No, this can't be happening. But yes, that's him, fists clenched, muttering to himself. He has showered and changed, at least. His hair is combed, and he's wearing a white polo shirt and blue seersucker Bermudas. This is almost worse, she decides. He looks respectable. I've gotten the address wrong, Kirby tells the taxi driver. Keep going.
Keep going where? The taxi driver asks.
Kirby leans over the seat and notices a tattoo of a snarling Elvis on his forearm. Methodist campground? Kirby says. She doesn't know Darren's exact address. The big blue house? Judge Frazier's house? Do you know it?
I do, actually, the driver says.
He winds around Ocean Park and a few moments later pulls up in front of Darren's house.
$125.
Kirby gives him $1.50, then gets out of the taxi. She stands at the white gate for a second, wondering if she would be better off waking up Evan in the basement or finding a payphone. There's one over by the fudge shop and calling the police directly. But she's here. She strides up the walk and knocks on the front door. A second later,
she's face to face with the good doctor. Dr. Fraser is wearing athletic shorts and a white tank top. Her hair is held off her face by a striped sweatband.
Hello, she says. Dr. Fraser.
Darren's asleep, she says. He doesn't have to be at work until noon.
I have an urgent situation, Kirby says. I need his help.
What kind of urgent situation? Dr. Fraser asks. Her voice is arch. Kirby holds the woman in high esteem, and she wishes the feeling were mutual, but it just isn't. And now she can't even lean on Mr. Ames's good opinion of her.
It's my roommate, Kirby says. She's dating someone who hurts her, and he's waiting for her now outside the house on Narragansett.
Kirby watches Dr. Fraser struggle between doctor mode and mother mode. Mother mode wins.
What does this have to do with Darren?
Nothing, but
I think it's better that he not get involved, Dr. Fraser says. He's a good boy. He stays out of trouble.
I take it your roommate's boyfriend is white?
Kirby nods. She doesn't understand what that has to do with anything.
If Darren gets into an altercation with a white boy, Dr. Fraser says.
She narrows her eyes.
You should find someone else to help you.
I thought maybe Darren could reason with him.
Men who hurt women can't be reasoned with, Dr. Fraser says. If it's serious, call the police.
It's serious, Kirby says.
Okay, then. Would you like to use the phone?
Would she like to use the phone? Dr. Fraser is watching her closely, possibly to determine her motives. Do the police need to be called, or is she really here only so she can see Darren?
You're welcome to come in, Dr. Fraser says.
I have nothing against you personally, Kirby.
But you do, Kirby thinks,
though she doesn't have time to defend herself right now.
I'll go get my landlord, Kirby says. Thank you, Dr. Fraser. Sorry to bother you so early.
Kirby turns and hurries back down the walk and out the gate while, she's sure, Dr. Fraser watches her from the doorway. Kirby runs toward Narragansett Avenue. She won't wake Evan. She can handle Luke herself. She's a block and a half away when things start to unfold. A black sedan pulls up in front of the house, and Patty gets out of the passenger side. Kirby can't see who's driving, but the car is unfamiliar. The car drives off.
Patty! Kirby yells.
Patty turns toward Kirby's voice, but then Luke approaches her and Patty hugs him. They start kissing right there on the sidewalk, and Kirby thinks, okay? Maybe Luke has had a chance to calm down. But still, Kirby is concerned. And sure enough, Luke pushes Patty away hard so that she stumbles, and then he grabs her by the hair and starts pulling her up the stairs to the house. Kirby runs.
Let go of her!
Luke doesn't let go. He's swearing under his breath, calling Patty a whore, asking Patty where she spent the night, who she was with, how many guys she slept with. Patty is crying softly, saying,
I was with my sister Sarah. We were at a party on Chappie. Let go of me, Luke. You're hurting me.
I thought you liked it when I hurt you, Luke says.
Kirby takes the front steps two at a time and starts pummeling Luke's back.
Let go of her. Luke, stop!
Luke swings around and backhands Kirby right across the face. She's stunned. No one has ever hit her before. She brings her fingers to her lip. She's bleeding.
Are you kidding me? A voice says.
Kirby backs up a few steps as Darren comes charging up the stairs. He regards Luke for 1 second, then punches him. The hit is solid, the sound gruesome. Luke drops to the ground.
Go inside, Darren says to Kirby. Call the police.
Luke doesn't even bother getting up. He just lies splayed across the yard, whimpering. Patty kneels down next to him.
He's hurt, she says.
She glares at Darren.
You hurt him.
He hit Kirby, Darren says. Any man who would raise his hand to a woman does not deserve your sympathy.
It was self-defense, Patty says. Kirby was attacking him.
Attacking him?
Kirby says. Her face stings. She's going to have a fat lip.
He was dragging you by the hair like a caveman.
How many times do I have to tell you? Patty says. This is none of your business.
You don't deserve to be treated that way, Kirby says. I've seen the bruises, Patty, and the marks from where he slaps you.
Patty casts a sidelong glance at Darren and speaks through gritted teeth.
It's none of your business. You don't know what I like or don't like.
It's 1969, Kirby says. You don't have to tolerate him abusing you.
Patty gets to her feet and charges toward Kirby, and Kirby wonders if she's about to get hit for the second time in her life.
Butt out! I don't judge your preferences, so please don't judge mine.
She pulls Luke up.
Well, the fact is, he hit me, Kirby says. I could press charges.
Press away, Patty says.
Her eyes are wild with defiance. But beneath this, Kirby spies fear or insecurity. Or maybe it's just exhaustion. Kirby is guessing Patty didn't get much sleep on Chappie.
Come on, Luke.
Patty yanks Luke into the house, blatantly violating the no visitors of the opposite sex rule. The front door slams behind them. Kirby and Darren stare at each other in dumbfounded silence.
What should I do? Kirby asks.
Just then, a police car rolls up, and Kirby feels a wave of relief. Maybe someone else reported the disturbance. Patty's screaming could have woken the dead.
Edgartown? Darren says.
Kirby doesn't understand at first, but then she notices it's the Edgartown police, not the Oak Bluffs police, which is very unusual indeed. An officer gets out of the car and strides up the walk. He nods at Kirby and Darren.
I'm looking for Patricia O'Callaghan, he says.
Kirby can't decide if she should linger and try to eavesdrop, or if she should just head up to the igloo and go to sleep.
I should probably get some ice, she says to Darren.
Gently, he touches her swollen lip. I'm gonna wait until he comes out and then give him a proper licking.
The police are handling it, Kirby says.
She wonders if maybe it was Mr. Ames who called the Edgartown police.
You're right,
Darren says. He smiles at her, and Kirby allows herself to be sucked into the warmth of his brown eyes. He's handsome, genuine, kind, and flat-out superior to every other boyfriend she has ever had. But he will never be hers. Kirby wants to blame this on history or society, but the fact is, her own bad decisions are the obstacle.
Thank you for coming to the rescue, Kirby says. My hero.
Anytime, Darren says.
Kirby is lying face down on her bed, too tired to remove her yellow daisy dress, but not too tired to play Simon and Garfunkel, when she hears the scream. She lifts her head an inch. It's Patty. Although Kirby's first instinct is to leap into action, she stays put. Patty made it perfectly clear that she doesn't want Kirby's help. There's a second scream, and then footsteps on the stairs and pounding on Kirby's door. She rises to find Michaela and Barb.
You need to come downstairs, Michaela says. She's asking for you.
Something's happened, Barb says. Kirby isn't sure what she's going to find, but she certainly doesn't expect to see both Luke and the police officer standing idly by while Patty wails. When Kirby descends the stairs, Patty looks up. Her face is crumpled and beet red.
Mary Jo, Patty says.
Kirby blinks.
Mary Jo Kopechne? Sarah's friend?
Patty says.
Someone drove off the dike bridge with her in the car, and she was trapped. She drowned Kirby. She's dead.
Whiter shade of pale. Reprise. Kate called David with the happy news about the twins, and he said,
That's wonderful, Kate. You must be overjoyed.
The you worried her. She didn't like the way he was distancing himself from her and the family. It was very unlike him. David adored Blair and, as he did with all of Kate's children, treated her like his own.
Won't you come this weekend and meet them? Kate asked. Please?
David issued a mighty sigh. This, Kate thought, was when he'd tell her he wanted a divorce.
"What if I got us a room at the Gordon Folger?" Kate asked.
This was what they used to do when they were dating, back when Exalta made no secret of the fact that she disapproved of Kate getting involved with someone so soon after Wilder's death, and her own lawyer to boot. Exalta insisted that there were rules about that sort of thing, but what she really meant was her own rule that Kate stick to Boston Brahmins.
"A room at the Gordon Folger won't be necessary," David said. "I'd like to spend some time with my daughter."
"Our daughter," Kate said.
"Our daughter, yes, Kate," David said. "But I'm not up to fighting traffic Friday night. I'll take a ferry midday Saturday and leave Sunday afternoon before the crush."
He would be on Nantucket a scant 24 hours, Kate thought, and from the sound of it, that was mostly so he could see Jesse. Apparently, Kate was no longer his first priority, nor was she worth sitting in traffic for. But she had behaved abominably this summer. She had no delusions about that.
"Thank you," she said. "It would mean the world to me. To us all."
David gave a dry laugh.
"Please warn Exalta of my impending arrival."
"Actually, Mother was just asking why we haven't seen more of you this summer," Kate said.
This was a lie, but at least Exalta hadn't said anything overtly negative about David, as she was wont to do.
"Kate, please," David said. "Don't make it worse."
He hung up. On Saturday morning, there's knocking on the front door of All's Fair that quickly turns sharp and insistent. Kate is exhausted. She stayed at the hospital until nearly 11 the night before, holding one baby while Blair nursed the other. She waits to see if either Exalta or Jesse will answer the door, but then she remembers that it's a weekend. No tennis lessons, so they won't be up. Kate rouses herself. It must be David here early, she thinks, and she smooths her hair before she ties the belt of her robe. The knocking continues. Why make such a ruckus, she wonders. Why not just let himself in? He knows they never lock the door. He's probably trying to make a point. This isn't his house, so he'll act like a guest. Halfway down the stairs, she freezes. It's not David, because the first ferry in doesn't arrive until 10. Who else would be knocking on the front door so early on a Saturday morning? Someone on a mission. Someone from the U.S. Army. Kate feels lightheaded. She sits on the step, fourth from the bottom. She won't answer the door. She can't. She'll sit here for the rest of her life if she has to. She will turn to stone, but she will not answer the door to the news that Tiger is dead. The knocking persists. A female voice says,
"Open up! I know you're in there!"
A woman? Kate thinks. She pushes herself to her feet. Standing on the front step is a woman with long dark hair. She's wearing a black and white tie-dyed t-shirt, a denim skirt, and an anklet made of tiny bells. Her feet are bare.
"Can I help you?" Kate asks.
This woman is a flower child, a hippie, and likely a beggar or here asking for money for some imaginary charity. But because Kate is awash with sweet relief, she'll give the woman a quarter and tell her to please be on her way. Maybe she'll send her down the street to Bitsy Dunscombe's house. Kate brightens at the very idea of this prank. The woman is wearing a pair of tiny, round, mirrored sunglasses. When she raises them, Kate sees ice-blue eyes.
Dear God, Kate thinks, and it takes everything in her power not to slam the door shut in the woman's face.
"Katie?" the woman says.
It's Lorraine. Lorraine Crimmins. Kate falls back on her manners.
"Lorraine," she says, "I'm sorry. You've given me a shock. We weren't expecting you, were we? Bill, your father, didn't say anything."
"He doesn't know I'm coming," Lorraine says. "He'll be more surprised than you."
"Ah," Kate says. She's at a complete loss.
"I'm sure he'll be happy to see you."
"Doubt that," Lorraine says. "But I didn't come to see the old man.
I came to get my boy.
Well, Kate says.
The polite thing to do is invite Lorraine in, but Kate can't bring herself to do it. Now that she's recovering from her shock, she feels the old hatred surfacing inside her, like pollution in a river.
You'll have to check with your father about that.
My understanding is you up and left Pick by himself. I'm not sure what reason a mother would ever have for doing such a thing, but if you ask me, you don't deserve the boy back. He's quite happy here with us. He has a job and a girlfriend. In the fall, he can go to high school here.
Ha!
Lorraine laughs like Kate has told a joke.
Come off it, Katie.
I heard him on the phone the other day, Lorraine, trying to call the place you live or used to live, looking for you. And no one could tell him where you were. He was upset.
Well then, he'll be happy to see me.
Kate shuts the door and leans against it. Lorraine starts pounding. Kate wants Exalta to wake up, but she sleeps with earplugs in, so there is little to no hope of her hearing all this. Ever so stealthily, Kate slides the deadbolt. There's a telltale click. Lorraine stops knocking. Good, Kate thinks. Lorraine gets the picture. She isn't welcome. Kate considers calling the police, but she can't bear to make a scene so early on a Saturday, or at all. Kate hurries down the hall, through the kitchen, and across the yard. She needs to wake up Bill Crimmins. But when she lets herself into Little Fair, she sees his bedroom is empty. A quick check out the window confirms his truck is gone. It's early, but not that early. Bill has already left for work. Kate leaves Little Fair just in time to see Lorraine opening the back door and entering the kitchen at All's Fair.
What are you doing? Kate calls out in a furious whisper. I did not invite you in.
She flies into the kitchen to find Lorraine already seated at the table. Lorraine chooses a peach out of the fruit bowl and takes a sloppy bite, her eyes defiant. Juice drips down her chin.
Get out!
Kate looms over Lorraine. She is so angry, she wants to strike her.
Go ahead, Lorraine says. Slap me.
I know you want to. You've wanted to for 16 years. She stands up and presents a cheek to Kate.
It will give me great satisfaction to watch Katie Nichols lose control.
You're despicable, Kate says. You were despicable then, and you're even more despicable now.
Where is your self-respect? You show up here barefoot like a common hobo. You stink to high heaven. And I'm sure you don't have any money.
True, Lorraine says with a smirk. I don't.
But my father will give me some.
Kate silently concedes that point. You are not staying here, Lorraine.
It's actually lavender now, Lorraine says, if you don't mind.
What I mind, Lavender, is you barging into our family home uninvited.
You know, I've actually missed this house, Lorraine says. It has so many unique features. The mural, the buttery.
Watch it, Lorraine, Kate says. She can't believe how brazen the woman is being. She must be on something.
And so many fine antiques. Exalta's whatchamacallits, and that spinning wheel.
Hey, do you remember when Kirby got in trouble for breaking the spinning wheel and she wouldn't apologize?
That's because I was the one who broke it. I had taken a bunch of your diet pills and I was buzzing and wanted to see how fast it could go.
Kate stares at Lorraine. Of course she remembers the broken spinning wheel. Was Lorraine confessing now, so many years later, that she had stolen Kate's diet pills? She had struggled to lose weight after giving birth to Tiger, and while speeding on those pills, she had broken the house's most valuable antique and then pinned the blame on a 5-year-old?
All the family secrets are coming out, Lorraine says with a lunatic smile.
One of her side teeth is missing.
I would have spoken up if Kirby got into any real trouble, but of course she didn't. She was Exalta's lapdog. By the way, how is Blair? Did she ever stop sucking her thumb? And what about my favorite, Little Tiger? How is our Little Tiger?
You're a whore, Kate says. A common whore.
Lucky for your husband, Lorraine says.
That's it. Kate snaps. She grabs Lorraine by the arm and pulls her toward the back door, but Lorraine digs into the linoleum with her dirty heels. Kate prays for her mother to appear. Lorraine has always looked up to Exalta, but the person who materializes on the back porch is Jessie. Kate wonders how long she's been standing there and what exactly she's heard. Behind Jessie is Pick, dressed in his mustard yellow board shorts with a towel draped around his neck, climbing onto his bike. Lorraine must see Pick also, because all of a sudden, she bursts forward, eager to go exactly where Kate wants her to go. Outside. It's a messy reunion, and loud. Lorraine is sobbing. She begs for forgiveness and professes her love. But Pick seems to rebuff his mother. Finally, however, he lets her hug him, and then they're embracing and rocking back and forth. Kate and Jessie watch from the back porch. Kate is incredulous. She can't believe Lorraine Crimmins has returned to Nantucket and that she had the gall to knock on the front door of All's Fair after the disgraceful way she left so many years ago. And yet, the reunion between mother and son is strangely touching. Tiger, Kate thinks. But Tiger is off fighting a war for the U.S. Army. He's fighting so that rootless, toothless floozies like Lorraine Crimmins can wander the country in bare feet. Is she taking him back to California? Jessie asks. Who knows, Kate says. What did she mean when... I'll explain later, Kate says. Right now, I have to find Bill Crimmins. Kate starts by calling down to the charcoal galley to see if Bill was in for breakfast and if he said where he was headed later. The waitress, Joelle, says, he's been doing handyman work at the Congregational Church all week. Wonderful. Kate calls the Congregational Church and asks the secretary in the office to please send Bill Crimmins home to Fair Street. His daughter has paid us a surprise visit from California, Kate says. Bill pulls up a few minutes later. Kate and Jessie are at the kitchen table. Kate is drinking her morning coffee, and through the window, she sees him slam his truck door shut and then slam into Little Fair. Kate has no idea what will transpire. Jessie, drinking juice and nibbling a piece of toast, watches him as well. Do you think? Jessie asks. I don't know and I don't care, Kate says. You shouldn't care either. They're not our family. Kate throws back what's left of her coffee. Not really. Not really. Lucky for your husband. Kate fills her coffee cup again and resists the temptation to add whiskey because David is coming today and she cannot, will not be drunk when he arrives. However, without alcohol, it's difficult to banish the ghosts. Wilder. Kate knew he was unfaithful early in the marriage. He had flirted with Kate's own cousin at their wedding reception in a way that was completely inappropriate. But it had taken her a while to realize just how crucial to his self-worth the philandering was. It didn't matter what Kate said or did. She would threaten to leave. He would earnestly promise to stop. A few weeks or months later, he would be back at the bars, coming home late, not coming home at all. It was, frankly, a relief when he left for Korea. When Wilder came home, he seemed like a new man, devoted, chastened, passionate about Kate, and Kate only. On Nantucket that summer, Exalta fawned all over him, telling all the ladies at the Field and Oar that Wilder was a war hero, and Kate's father, Penn, indulged him with scotch and good cigars. But after only a few weeks, the highs of Wilder's personality dropped into deep troughs. Kate was aware that Wilder had started taking Benzedrine overseas in order to stay sharp, and she suspected the habit had continued here at home. She could tell when he was high. His eyes had a certain glint, and he talked a mile a minute. The only thing that could bring him down softly was alcohol. That summer, there were late nights at Bosun's Locker, and then a string of nights when he didn't come home at all. One morning, he showed up with mud-caked shoes. He said he'd fallen asleep on a grave in the Quaker Cemetery, weeping over the men he'd lost in Korea. Another night, he brought half a pound of sand to bed with him. He told Kate he'd walked all the way to Surfside Beach, then from Surfside to Cisco, then from Cisco home. She had chosen to believe him. On what turned out to be the last of those nights, when Kate woke up and Wilder wasn't in bed, she went to the kitchen to make some warm milk. She heard a noise coming from the hallway, and when she'd gone to investigate, she'd found Wilder hiding in the buttery. At first, she thought he was in there alone, which wasn't too surprising. He was definitely drunk, and he might have mistaken her for Exalta or Penn and tried to hide. But then Kate caught a glimpse of a ghost-white foot sticking out of the back of the buttery. It was Lorraine. Lorraine Crimmins, who cooked and baked for Exalta, and who, that summer, was also minding the children. Their summer had ended abruptly right there. Kate packed up herself and the children that very night, and they had left on the early ferry, before her parents were even awake. "You can explain to them why I left," Kate told Wilder. "Stay here with her, if that's what you want." Kate had stood on the upper deck of the ferry with her car keys clenched like a weapon between her fingers as she watched Nantucket retreat into the distance. Lorraine Crimmins. It was such a betrayal. Lorraine had started working at the Nichols household when she was 16 years old, and Kate 20, a sophomore at Smith College. That was during the war. Kate had invited Lorraine to listen to the radio with her in the evenings. Together, they had knit socks for the men overseas. Kate had been kind to Lorraine because she pitied her. Lorraine was a sad case, ruined by her mother's death when she was a baby, doomed to disappoint and underachieve every step of the way after that. Lorraine was very pretty, but her style tended toward tawdry. She wore too much makeup when she went out at night, and her clothes were tight and cheap. At Bosun's Locker, she met men, scallopers, house painters, traveling salesmen, one after the other, no one special, no one serious. Wilder and Lorraine crammed into the buttery, given away by Kate glimpsing that one pale foot. It wasn't a vision Kate could ever hope to forget. Kate had told Wilder to stay with Lorraine, but as the ferry crossed the Sound, she feared that was exactly what he would do. Kate loved Wilder, and she hated herself for that. It seemed the cruelest circumstance life had to offer, that someone she loved so profoundly could hurt her so badly, and still that love did not die. If anything, it intensified. Kate wanted Wilder to love her, to desire her, not Lorraine Crimmins. Why her? Why Lorraine, of all people? Exalta had called the next day to check on Tiger's fever. "Tiger's fever?" Kate said. "Yes," Exalta said. Wilder had explained that Tiger was running a high fever, which was why Kate had taken the children to Boston in such a great hurry. The big war hero was a coward, Kate thought. Just as Kate was summoning the courage to tell Exalta the truth, as humiliating as it was, Kate would also gain great satisfaction in stripping Exalta of her illusions about the man. Wilder had walked through the door. He dropped to his knees in front of Kate, and she felt the mightiest relief she had ever known. A few minutes after Bill goes into Little Fair, Kate and Jesse watch all three of the Crimminses emerge from the house. Mr. Crimmins first, holding a duffel bag, then Lorraine, then Pick. Pick turns and sees Kate and Jesse and offers a half-hearted wave. Jesse gets up and takes a step forward, but Kate says, "Let them go." The last thing she wants is a grandiose, overblown goodbye, and she can't get close to Lorraine again, or she will do something she is sure to regret. "But," Jesse says. She gazes at her mother with her liquid brown eyes. "I'm in love with him." Kate processes this information. "Come with me," she says. "I want to talk to you." Midnight Confessions. Jessie follows her mother up the stairs of Little Fair. It's almost unbearable to be here now that Pick is gone, really gone. Jessie would even prefer him being here with Sabrina. She thinks back to the day she arrived,
when she found Pick playing that dumb ball and paddle game. She feels like she walked into a trap. Pick was so cute with his sun-bleached hair and his rope bracelet and his easy charm, asking Jessie questions, taking an interest in her, making her a simple, delicious lunch when she was so hungry. It was impossible not to fall immediately in love with him. Kate indicates that Jessie should sit at the table, and Jessie does so, though her heart breaks because he didn't leave a note for her or anything. No sign that they'd been friends or that he'd miss her. Probably he'd been worried about Sabrina, or maybe not. Maybe he was just happy that his mother came to reclaim him. Jessie hadn't been able to tell from the look on his face. "You know what the happiest summer of my life was?" Kate asks. "When you turned 13?" Jessie guesses. "I was 13 during the Great Depression," Kate says, "so, no." Jessie doesn't venture another guess. Frankly, she doesn't care. "It was the summer you were born," Kate says. "Your dad and I brought you here when you were only 4 weeks old, just a little peanut. And we lived up here in Little Fair all by ourselves, and the other three kids stayed in the big house with Nonny and Gramps." "Oh," Jessie says. She's only old enough to remember when her siblings lived in Little Fair by themselves. "I was happy." "Well, probably because I had a little bit of space from Nonny. It was just you, me, and Daddy. It felt like a fresh start. And I desperately needed a fresh start." Jessie runs her Tree of Life pendant along its chain as her mind wanders back to the exchange she overheard between her mother and Lorraine Crimmins. Kate had called Lorraine Crimmins a whore, and Lorraine, instead of getting angry like Jessie assumed she would, said, "Lucky for your husband." Jessie had gotten a funny feeling then, like a door was opening, a secret door, and she was finally getting a glimpse of what lurked behind it. She knows a whore is a prostitute, a woman who gets paid to have sex with men, and she knows that when Lorraine said, "Lucky for your husband," she meant Wilder Foley, not David Levin. Wilder Foley and Lorraine Crimmins? Jessie thinks back to the puberty talk at the end of the school year, and she feels herself flush because she suddenly knows what her mother wants to talk to her about. Jessie hasn't been paying attention to her mother, who's been talking about how Kate and David brought Jessie everywhere that summer in her carriage and her baby basket. They had even taken her on a cabin cruiser all the way over to Tuckernuck. "Mom," Jessie says, interrupting her, "is Pick?" She doesn't know how to ask what she wants to ask, but it hardly matters because she knows the answer is yes.